Today's guest really needs no introduction, but I'll do my best for the sake of the podcast. If you dance blues or Lindy Hop, you likely know the name Dr. Feelgood, aka Stephen Watkins, who is our guest today. He started dancing in 1998 and began his blues DJing career at his other adoptive home, St. Louis's Cheap Thrills, in 2004. And since then, he has DJed all over the nation and spreads his love for blues with a warm mixture of smooth, gritty, sultry, in-your-bones, hot skirt music. As anybody who has talked to him or any other DJ knows, we are opinionated. I myself DJ for West Coast Swing Dancers, and I have my opinion on what DJs should do and how music should help run a night in a dance. And the more and more you talk to Stephen, the more you realize the depth of knowledge that he has, not just because he is a dancer, but because he genuinely loves the music. And he'll talk about how he started DJing with CD decks and how he moved forward and what it takes to be a DJ and why that is so hard to teach. And without further ado, I'm just going to jump right into the interview, and I hope you enjoy. I'm Dr. Chelsea Adams, and this is 12 Bar Talk. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing very well. Yourself?
I'm excited to have you on as somebody who spent a long time laying essentially a foundation for blues community DJs to think about how they choose and play their music.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought and philosophy, because it's not the easiest thing in the world, but yeah, I'm proud of it. I love it. There's a lot of reasons, and we can get to all of them.
Yeah. So just even starting out, how did you get into blues DJing? How did that come about?
Well, I'd actually been dancing for a long time in New York, which is where I'm from, and doing Lindy and so on, and started blues probably in the maybe 2000 or maybe 2001 thereabout. And I'd been going to different exchanges and events and so on. I was hearing a lot of music, but I wasn't hearing a whole lot of blues music. What people were doing, which makes perfect sense, is playing jazz that worked for the dance. They were playing a lot of soul that worked for the dance, and a smattering of blues music. And I think it was probably about 2 years of me listening and traveling. And I mean, I love the dance and I love the music, but I remember thinking, okay, you guys, there's so much more. I think because of my love of radio, this might be my opportunity to do this. I had done radio in college for 4 years and so on, 4.5. I actually stayed a half semester longer because I wanted to do more radio. It had been some years, but my main thought was, you know what? I don't know exactly how to break in, but I was going to St. Louis, which is one of my other blues homes, actually, for their event. And I asked a friend of mine, Clay Hellman. I can still hear the conversation because I was like, God, who's the DJ coordinator? And Clay was like, why? And I was like, I kind of want a DJ. And he was like, really? Now, Clay was a DJ also. And it's like, so you want a DJ? And he kept asking me like that, really, you want a DJ? In my mind, I was like, yeah. So finally, yes, I do. And he goes, okay, well, I know who the coordinator is. And I was like, who? He goes, it's me. Oh, okay. So I got there and I had a slot on Friday night, if I remember correctly. My thought going in was not, can I DJ? It's a matter of, but can I DJ for a dance? Because that's a little bit different. So what I did was I just thought in my head about what the arc is that I want in radio. I just want to bring people up, bring it up, bring it up, bring the tempo up, bring tempo up, and then bring it back down, bring it back down, bring it back down. However many songs that was going to be. And I'd work it out from there. So my first set, I thought, all right, I'll know after the first 3 or 4 songs, because what people like is familiarity. It just works. And I knew I was going to be playing some music that people have not heard. I already knew it. I knew they were. And But I was very confident in the fact that I'm going to be playing some really good music here, and it's going to work for what you do. And the third song I remember in my arc, and the third song hit, and I'm looking at the dance floor, and I thought to myself, oh, I got y'all now. And that was it. It just escalated from there. I had a really, really good first set. I was not scheduled the second night. They gave me a set the second night when Heidi Fight's husband at that time, Charlie, got sick. So they gave me the next set, an early set, like midnight, when people are transitioning in. People are leaving one place, coming to the next place. And I was at the late night next place. So I thought, all right, what I'm going to do here is I want people to hustle in the door, because I want to give you that feeling you might miss something. Or as you're coming in, if you're not exactly certain as to where you're going, you're going to hear the music and go, oh, that must be the place. So I did that. So I played a little faster tempo. And this would have been 2004. So this was at a time when people were dancing both Lindy and blues, and they would kind of mix it in. So it made me, it made it a lot easier to play faster tempos, a lot easier. People were really good with their floor craft and so on. So really good set on a Saturday. Sunday, I was ready to bring the house down in a sense, which is basically what I did. It's funny. I'm so remembered by a lot of people that were there. That third set, people talk about that third set to me, like even today, and it's been quite some time.
And that is fantastic to get started that way. And I appreciate that you said that there's like an art to DJing, because as somebody who has DJed for the last decade for West Coast swing dancers, largely understanding the power of the DJ to control the room, I think is highly underestimated or even overlooked, that a lot of times it's the DJ that makes or breaks the environment with the music choices. So could you talk a little bit more about how radio maybe, or just your understanding of music, helped create those choices that you're talking about, that people still remember that?
Growing up in general, I've always paid attention to what the DJ was playing, whether it was club music, you know, mixed in with R&B and so on. Growing up in New York and then parts of New Jersey, dance clubs, especially if you're in a black crowd, one of the things that you will learn really quickly is how in tuned your dance floor is to what your DJ is doing. Now you have to mix in dance music. So I can assure you, if you're playing music, if you're DJing for a dance, playing club music and so on, or if you're playing disco or what have you, funk, and you're mixing your songs, that crowd, if you make a half a mistake, that crowd is on you. And it's on you in a funny way, because people will be dancing and they hear the mix coming. So you learn to do that. I'd always learn to listen to what song you're sneaking in, and people would be like, you know, the dance floor would be, and say, don't do that now, which is, of course, do it. And don't look out now. That's my song. Don't do that. And if you mess it up, the whole room will go, ah, and they'll keep dancing, though. But it's really, really funny. So I always kept that in mind in terms of, you know, even when I was like 17 years old up to, you know, in my 30s, and realizing that's what you kind of have to do. You have to, the DJ is your MC, is your host, basically, which is how I looked at it. That's how I was brought up in terms of radio. So I transferred that. Everything I learned at school, everything I learned going to the clubs and watching, I transferred to the, you know, the blues dance floor.
Well, that's fantastic to even think about the concept of being a host. That is, I think a lot of DJs just think, I create a set and I play that set and it goes over or it doesn't go over, based on like the dancers that are in the room that day, or if they're finicky, rather than I'm hosting, how can I adjust? So that's definitely a difference in understanding of what a DJ does.
I'll tell you this, and this may sound, no, it is going to sound a bit arrogant. There's someone I remember that was standing talking to me while I was DJing once, and what he watched what I did. So when I did start DJing, and the fact that I'm playing music that people aren't hearing or had not heard before, I hit kind of like a sensation in a way. What happened to me in 2004 can't happen now, because people have heard a lot of, and have really gotten into and started to explore and research and listen to the music now, but they hadn't done it then. So, I mean, I'm very proud of the fact that I jumped in. You know, I'm not the first person in a sense, but I'm the first person to kind of do it nationally. So one of the things I would see, and this is where the arrogant part comes in, is if I'm DJing and other people, like I was brand new, remember? So people didn't know me. So a lot of these other people are established. You know, they were the names. So if I'm DJing in between two names, I was listening and I knew what the person before me played. So I didn't repeat any songs. So if so-and-so played something, I'm like, okay, I'm not going to play that. I probably wouldn't play it all weekend, but that's okay because I've got music you don't have anyway. That's fine. I'd listen to his or her set. It was primarily all him at the beginning at that time. There weren't a whole lot of, you know, women DJing. I'm glad that's changed, actually, very much so. I'd play my set. And during my set, I would look and the DJ next following me would be dancing. But then I'd see that same DJ slipping over to three quarters of the way through, midway through my set. And I'd look over and I'd see him at his computer. And I already knew what was happening, which is you'd set your playlist up and you walked away, which is what it was that you just said. Now you're hearing or seeing that I am reading the room. I'm also manipulating the room in a way to how I want and how it is the dance floor translates back to me. Because I act like it's theater. I see how where people are and how people are dancing. And I will not necessarily tailor a set a particular way. But if I see someone dancing a certain way that inspires me, it's like, oh, okay, but that's where we're going right now. It was really funny to watch people run and change their set, you know, and like, I gotta go. And I'm like, okay, you'll remember next time you see me, okay? Because there were a lot of obstacles. That's why I felt that way at the time. People were not, you may have felt this at one time or another, especially when you started DJing. Those obstacles that were in your way, a lot of established people might not have wanted to give you a chance. And I definitely had that.
There's a couple of really interesting dynamics here I want to ask you about just as a deeper dive, which is that you talk about, you know, there's this group of people playing a very specific set of jazz and soul type music, and you're adding blues in, which at least in my experience DJing, I have to laugh a little bit about this concept of genre. And I get people tell me all the time, oh, you play so much blues, and maybe I've played three blues songs on a night, right? Because people hadn't been exposed to it. They don't understand the difference between those genres. They just think if it sounds older or has a certain feel to it, it must be blues. Acoustic must be the same, right? So when you choose those songs that you're placing in to, you know, introduce these dancers to new music, what is the balance, or how do you strike that balance between the familiar and pushing into their belief systems about what blues is and what it should sound like, what's danceable, and how do you curate your library based on that?
Oh, okay. Now, I actually didn't go in that direction. My honest thought was the music, I wasn't playing music that I like. I'm playing music I love. One of the things that Jerry Warwick said to me and around me about me was, I remember almost overhearing this. And Jerry said, Stephen doesn't play any filler songs. What I did was, and because he's right, what I did was I took my CDs, because I was playing CDs at that time and for a long time, actually, but I took them off my shelves. So I was playing the music I love to hear. My mother and my father introduced me to this music. So I looked at it in a sense of, even to this day, I'm introducing the dance floor to my father. That's just how I look at it, with all that love and all that passion for him and for the music. The songs that I play are generally, I mean, they're not all hits, because we don't necessarily remember, you know, hits, or you weren't around at that time for hits. But good music is good music. Knowing the dance, knowing the rhythms, knowing the flow I want, you know, in terms of radio and how I wanted to bring the floor up, bring it up, bring it up, bring it down, bring it down, bring it down. I would choose my songs accordingly. I don't choose songs ahead of time. I just improvise every single set. I look at the dance floor to see where it was and where it seems like it wants to go. Each song I choose, it isn't the first song, not the most important song. It's what's next, what's next. No one cares when you go into the barbershop, well, who's first? No one says, well, okay, who's first? It's always, who's next? You step on the basketball court waiting to play. It's who's got next? That's all it is. What's next?
And I think that's really powerful. I also don't prefab set lists. I show up and I see who showed up, and I build it song by song. And I'm surprised how many people are surprised by that approach. And yet I find it incredibly powerful because you need to know what's next. I spend most of my time watching a floor thinking, what's next? What does the dance floor need or want? So I also am in agreement with what you're saying there. And I also want to talk within that about the energy of music. You've talked several times now about the rise and fall of energy. And a lot of beginner DJs in particular, I find, think it's all about BPM. And yet I would love to hear your thoughts, because I'm kind of pushed back against that. It says energy is a lot more than BPM. And you can have high energy songs that don't have the same tempo per se, right? So how do you view energy versus BPM and speed to build that rise and fall?
Okay. Energy in a song. The way I see this is it's tension. So each, as you just said, I agree with you implicitly. Beats per minute doesn't really mean a whole lot to me. Not at all. People have asked me about that a lot. In fact, I'm like, I have no idea what beats per minute are. First, doesn't matter what genre I'm playing in. I just don't care. What I'm more concerned about is how the song feels. And I'm keying in on particular instruments at one time or another and what becomes prominent. But most importantly, I don't want music that kind of that's repetitive. Well, I'm not going to, for a dance, not necessarily at home, personally, what you're listening to. I'm not disparaging that. What I am saying, for as you're playing for a dance and you're trying to move your crowd, what I would hope someone wants is music that takes you on a journey in a song. So whether it's 3 minutes, whether it's 6 minutes, whether it's 11 minutes. And yes, I do play songs that may be 11 minutes long. A good example for this was during, I think it was 2004. And one of the songs that used to be played a lot, which was kind of R&B, kind of soul, was India Irie's Brown Skin, which was, it's a great song. Other DJs would play it. And I remember I played it one night and a woman named Margaret came to me after I played the song. And she goes, you know, it's kind of like I never noticed this before, but I had a problem. And I was like, really? What was going on? And she said, the song didn't go anywhere. She said, I'm intrigued now. Tell me more. And she said, the lead she was dancing with, as she put it, was not as experienced as her. So he ran out of moves. He ran out of things to do with her, unfortunately, dance-wise, because the song was so repetitive and it stayed in one place. Brown skin, you know, your brown skin over and over and over. And the melody was just stayed in one spot. And when she said it, I thought, you know what? You're right. And it was just the last time I ever played it. I knew other people were going to play it, so it's fine. You can still hear the song out there. I was done playing that because she was 100% correct. The song really didn't go anywhere. It was, if it's 4 minutes, it's spent by 2.5, by 2 minutes, 10 seconds. It's done with its journey. I want something that's going to take you on a, you're not sure. Oh, this is going over here. Oh, wait, we're coming back down again. It's a pull. It's a push. It pulls you out some more. And as it pushes you again, it's like a roller coaster ride or driving on a twisty highway. That's kind of how I relate it. But that example that Margaret explained to me about what she dealt with in that dance, and I did remember watching the dance, but I would have never articulated it that way until she said it. And I'm so glad I listened to her.
Yeah, no, that's a really good example, because I think when we're looking at songs, we only often will be like, oh, is it too long? So people run out of moves, rather than thinking, what is the complexity of the song that allows you to create within it and add your flair on it as a dancer, rather than just like completely keep the same solid beat and the same, you know, little riff throughout the song. Right. And I know exactly what you're talking about. I know that song. I'm pretty sure I've played that song. It's been a long time, but like it's one of those that it does that.
It's as if to give it even another example, it's like the song Happy. Was it Pharrell?
Pharrell.
Pharrell did that, did Happy. What's brilliant about Happy is that if you listen to it, it's all refrain. It's the entire song practically is refrain. And when I say refrain, it's refrain is the part by the time you listen to that 3 minute song, you're so in it. It's, oh yeah, you're still there. And it's like, yeah, you're through the journey that has taken you to the end. So the refrain is repeating. And this is that every song pretty much has a refrain. Well, Happy is nothing but refrain. And I was like, God, that's brilliant. You talk about cutting to the chase. You went right to the end, it seemed, and it's called Happy. You gave us this energetic tune that kept us 6 feet off the ground. And you didn't bring us down, you know, because the refrain is at the end. And that's where you keep us, whether it's, you know, whether it's blues, whether it's R&B, whether it's a rock song, no matter what it is, that refrain keeps you in the pocket of your song. Here's this guy did the whole song that way.
It is brilliant. And I will still get requests for that song. West Coast Swing mm-hmm. Dances, right? Because there is something powerful about, even if it's a cover of that song, it's playing off of that refrain mm-hmm. of that drive. And speaking of that, people feel like it's over too soon, right? They're so excited about the song and they want more, which brings us back to your comment about length, right? You'll play an 11 minute song, which I do want to hear the story of, but there is something about the perception of time passing for dancers that a 2 minute song can feel like 10 minutes and a 5 minute song can feel like two.
Now here's the trick. Generally, if I play a song that is 9 minutes or 11, like I said, I know I've got an 11 minute song. It's really more of a trick than anything else. And the trick being, it's a medley. So really there's three songs in there that the artist in particular knows that, oh, I could do this. and he did, you know, or she did, because there's two in particular I have. One's by B.B. King and another is by Esther Phillips. It just moves in seamlessly. There'll be a bridge at the end of each song, which will bleed into another. When the lyrics change, you know, all of a sudden it's a different song, but it's the same song because the tempo, the instrumentation, the orchestration, the arrangement, it's still the same with slight changes. So you don't necessarily feel like it's been 11 minutes. There is an Eric Clapton tune I played I can't remember the title because I won't play it again. It's from the soundtrack from Rush, this movie. It's 11 minutes. Honestly, the reason I won't play it again is because, is it a great song? Yeah, it's hot. It's got a lot of guitar. Well, I mean, yeah, Clapton. It's got a lot of guitar in it. It's got a lot of energy. But like I said about that India Irie song, all the movement ends probably at 3 minutes. And I hadn't noticed while I was at home, you know, just kind of listening to music. I was just like, oh, yeah, I got to play this. This will work. And then I played it and I was like, oh, this was a mistake. I need to get out of this song because this is way too long. This feels like we're watching paint dry. To me, that's how it felt. So I can't imagine, you know, the dance floor. In fact, I don't remember a lot of people complaining about it, but I was like, still, no, I'm not going to do that to you again. That's like assault. I'm so sorry.
Well, I think you're bringing up an important topic to dive in more to as well, which is that we're going to make mistakes as DJs. We think something's great, or we think this is a really great song, and not bother to listen to quite those last 30 seconds, or like we listen to the first minute and the last minute and skip the middle. And there's this huge space that it just wasn't the correct song. Right? I think every DJ at some point in their career has done that and then been like, whoops. So how do you handle those mistakes and help recover your dance floor as a DJ when those types of things happen?
I have not made that mistake. here's the reason why. And when I've tried to necessarily teach, I said, I have some surprises for you. When I've had to teach and so on, or tried to teach, because teaching this is not easy. It really isn't, because music is subjective. The hard part about that is, as far as the mistakes go, the thing I preach, and the reason why I have not made that mistake is, I mean, I do make mistakes, but it's not that mistake. Anyone that has ever been in a workshop with me knows this sentence: know your music, know your music, know your music inside and out. I was traveling across the country, going to exchanges, going to events, carrying two giant books of CDs. The reason I don't do a playlist, you know, ahead of time and set things up, why I do things on the fly, is because I know how every song I have, and I'm not kidding with this, I know how every song I have starts, and I know how every song ends. I know if a song I'm playing without listening to it ends with a hit, or if it ends with a fade, or if it's a live recording, if it ends in applause. And I know how long the applause goes. And all of that, I play into fading one song into another. What I look to do is give people a moment to breathe. You're going to say thank you to your partner, and you may have your eye out for who you're going to choose next, or who might be coming to select you. There's a moment of song ending and then song starting, but it's always a, and then next song. Now, if it's applause, if one song is ending with applause, I can drag the applause out and bring it down a bit. And that becomes the, now then the next song, that depends, what do I want? What I'm, because I, there's no rock solid rule. I might take that applause and drag it out. And even though I know people can still hear it, I'm going to play a song with a piano lead in. Like, say, for example, Pussycat Moan, which is, it's got that boom, 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 and tinkling of keys. And it, that gives people a chance to recognize if you've heard it before, or if you haven't, you're generally it's, ooh, what's that? As you're searching for the partner, and you're looking at the ceiling, looking, oh, where's this music coming from? What is that song? So that's essentially why I don't make that mistake, knowing your music. And you have to know it inside and out. You can't do the cheat of the, I'm going to listen to the beginning, I'm going to listen to the end. One of the main reasons for that is because that middle can change drastically. There is one song in particular that I have that I couldn't wait to play in St. Louis. I used to do that. I'd save a particular song every now and then for, you know, going to St. Louis. I remember I have Etta James singing. It's a live version singing Misty. Misty begins, it's a very slow song. He's like, look at me, I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree, and so on. And it stays there. And I'm listening to it. It gets to in the middle. And when the second I heard it, I was like, oh, I know what's about to happen. And then it picked up to a Lindy-ish beat. And when I heard, and then it continues the rest of the song. It might be a 4-4, but is probably what it actually is. If I'm musically, I don't know the timing that well. When I heard this and then listened to it, I thought, okay, I'm not playing this again at all until I get there. The reaction that day, that night, that was my next to last song. I'll never forget this. Watching the dance floor and everybody's close and so on. And then was in the pocket. And the whole room was, oh, it's like, got you. Got you. And then talking to some of my other friends who are DJs, I think it might have been Jerry. Hope you don't mind me saying this, Jerry. I think it was Jerry that said, God, I have this song. I didn't know it did that. And I said, you have to listen to it. You have to listen to it. That has happened to me a bunch of times. That's very funny. Now, to be honest, and also to be correct, the mistake that I make, they're pretty good, but not intended. I have played the wrong song, believe me. The mistake I make is not, I'm playing the song I didn't want to play. Usually more, I would say 90, almost 99%, the song that gets played is still really, really good. Just not what I was intending. you know, and it doesn't break the spell any. It's just like, okay, I have to make an adjustment for myself as I'm DJing. How long have you been DJing
I've been
yourself?
DJing since 2012, so 11 years.
2012. Okay, perfect. We have not met until now, really. So, but I'm going to presume this has happened to you, or you that you feel this. Your set doesn't necessarily begin with your first song. Your set begins for you when all of a sudden you feel, ooh, I'm in this with my own music. Am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So,
And I think you've got the sense of, I wrote down inspire curiosity, right? The sense of, I am looking to build a sense of curiosity, of eagerness, and it should also be building in me that, like, I know my music so well that I'm grabbing that next song because it needs to be there and it's inspiring me that love your music, know your music. Why would I be playing things I don't like? Because there's probably a reason that I don't like it. And people come to hear me DJ. They don't come because, I'm somebody else. They come because they know what they're going to get with me, which is that new music, the house party feel, the, hey, there's curiosity in what you're playing.
Exactly. And that curiosity is a great choice of words there. It honestly is. Because I would say that all I've said this for years. When the set happens for me, it's like I hear this music. I've heard it back and forth. I know it back and forth. I've heard it constantly. The person that can get bored from the music is me because I'm the one that's heard it. If all of a sudden I'm inspired, oh, look out. This here we go. We are in for a time, you know, hopefully. And it usually works out. How that's backfired but in a good way. When I first started DJing in New York, you know, doing house parties and so on, one of my friends came to me and I was still in my radio mood, my mode, but not, I hadn't refined it fully, I guess, maybe put it that way. My friend Marino came to me and he said, you know, it's great. God, we love that you put so much into the music, into introducing so many new songs all the time. He goes, and I was like, oh, okay, but thank you. It's like, God, I love it. I'm glad that you guys are feeling it. And then Marino said, there's one thing. I was like, okay, what's that? He said, well, it's like you're so in tune to introducing all these this wide range of songs. Sometimes you kind of forget like some of the older songs, and we love those too. You can bring those back a little bit now. And I was like, oh, okay, you know what? You're right. I'm glad you said it, because to me, in my mind, you don't play, I don't repeat. So if you were on the radio every day, you don't want to, you know, I mean, top 40 is top 40, you know, rotation is heavy rotation, but you don't want to do that because you're thinking you're going to wear them out. What you're doing is you're thinking about not wearing you out. They haven't heard it as much. I had to realize that. I'm very glad that people, you know, criticize me in certain ways, which
But
because it's
it's
been very, very
true,
helpful.
right? It's very
Yep, it
helpful
is.
because I remember I had probably listened to, a specific blues song thinking that, like, I need to make sure where I think this fits on a certain night and I want to be ready to play it. And I've heard it inside and out, know every note of this. And I played it and then I didn't play it for a few more months, right? Because, and somebody says, you play a song and I've never heard it before and then you don't play it again. And I'm thinking, well, that is because, just like you said, we hear these songs 20, 30, 100 times, however many times you play it before it hits the dance floor, and you feel like it's overplayed because you have overplayed it in your head.
That which cracks me up because, you know, you're in your own head, literally. Because you're right. But it's funny. It's very funny. There's that internal of I've got to inspire me, and inspiring me will help inspire you. But I also need to be inspired by you, which of course helps me. You know, which is why I said earlier, I treat it like theater. That's where I actually wound up going. I was like, all right, let me, if the floor is dead, I'm in trouble. I don't know, you know, I can only do but so much, you know, but once they're in it, and if you read the floor right, you're in it quickly, and you'll stay in it for an hour and a half, 2 hours, however it needs be.
And I think that right there, thinking of it as theater and reading a room and being able to enliven a dance floor in a way that that energy keeps flowing is something that is really hard for beginner DJs, especially thinking about teaching it. Like you said, teaching is hard because music is subjective. And how do you teach somebody to read the nonverbal cues and body language of a floor? So those are questions that a lot of beginner DJs have, I think.
Here's one of the tough parts. Well, an extra tough part about that, because there's more than one side of it. If I'm reading a floor, one of the things that I'll do is I am literally scanning what the entire time. I mean, yeah, I've got almost like one eye on what I'm wanting to play, how much I know how much time I've got left in a particular song, thinking to myself what it is that, where am I going? And looking at the dance floor, which will help me determine where we're going. One of the things that I'll do, if I see a couple generally that has not separated, you know, sometimes a couple may be dancing and they might be an actual couple, they might not be, but are dancing to their own in the song that you're playing. The rest of the room might be moving a whole other way and they have totally slowed the dance down to where they want it, where they need it. I almost always see that. And whenever I do see it, I just think, oh, you're in the set with me, because that's where I am. You're in the set with me. Now, the next thing is I'm actually looking at them thinking, I want to keep you there. How long can I keep those two people together on the dance floor? And let's see what happens next. Look, let's see how the room responds to that. And that can be fascinating. It's a lot of fun. It's a powerful challenge, but it's also really expressive with your music, with the music.
I think that is really fun and really powerful. It is similar for me when I'm looking at it and I have somebody come up to me and they're like, I'm leaving. And then they go, oh, but I can't. But you keep playing these songs. I meant to leave an hour ago and I keep dancing with people that I feel like I need to dance with. Those are ways that I know, at least personally, that I'm being successful is people say, I was going to leave at 11 and here it is almost 1 a.m. and you're still keeping me on the dance floor because they're hearing that inspiration.
I'll tell you, that is, you are spot on. That is one of the biggest compliments that I've gotten a lot. And I'm glad I've gotten it a lot of times. So somebody comes up and is like, it's like, I'm trying to go home, but I can't. And then they're laughing because you won't let me go. And I'm like, oh, wow. Thank you. I'll try. And they're like, no. You know what? I'm like, of course I know what you're saying. Cause I've been in that position too. There's a DJ in Chicago, Riley. I was at a Lindy event. I think it was maybe 2000. And he was, I don't remember if we were in Connecticut or if we were in New York. Well, it might have been New Jersey. And it's the first time I ever saw him. And he was playing, this guy was unreal, on fire this night. And I was just, I was a dancer, you know, just dancing, but I could not leave. Not only could I not leave, I kept running up to DJ booth. Dude, what are you playing? It's like, this is bad. What song is this? And he was so generous with time, energy, information, you know, in being interrupted every couple of minutes by this guy he didn't know, you know, me. And I don't know how many times I ran up there to him, but I felt like I was being intrusive, but he was so gracious and so nice to me. And besides killing us in the room, I was like, this is outrageous. 4 years later, I was DJing in Chicago at a friend's, at a friend Titus's house. It's at a house party. I was told Riley was coming and I was like, okay. I literally told people, someone needs to let me know when Riley arrives during my set. I need to know. Someone did. It's like, oh, Riley just walked in the room. And I was like, look out, everybody look out. Because in my mind, I'm not saying this out loud, but in my mind, I was like, we are kicking it into another gear. I had to envision, because I didn't see him. I think we were on two floors, I think, in this house, if I remember correctly. Riley came to me at the end of my set with a towel. He was like brushing the sweat off of him. He was like, oh my God, that set was unbelievable. And I said, that set was for you. Thank you for that night that we were together. You were DJing and I was dancing and running up to you. I said, you didn't disparage me. You didn't discourage. You didn't blow me off or whatever term you want to use. I said, you were so good with information and you were so nice to me. I said, man, I've been waiting to repay this to you for years because I could not go to bed. I couldn't leave. You had me trapped and I damn if I wasn't going to return the favor. I was going to make sure. And we were like, we've been good friends ever since. But that was in my head. I was like, look out. This is where we're going.
I think when we're looking at DJing as mentorship,
I know that when somebody comes up to me super excited about a song or keeps asking those questions, I don't want to shut that down. I want to encourage that because maybe they'll come up and be the next DJ, right? Be able to create those things. So I think those types of opportunities are really important. And I appreciate DJs that take the time to talk to me or to talk or people who are aspiring DJs or even just really big music enthusiasts to come up to me and talk to me and ask me questions, because that's how I got better. I had somebody who mentored
me. Absolutely. That is the way to go. That's what I would, when I was teaching and things, I tried to hammer that down to you, because you never know who you're talking to, first of all. And people love the music. If somebody's coming up to you about it, it's because they like it. It's not because they don't. When I first started, there were a lot of people, a lot of DJs. I won't go into their names. Maybe another night, maybe somebody catches me on a bad mood. However, a lot were that dismissive and not wanting to talk to you or not wanting to say what the song is. And yeah, of course, now you can Shazam. You couldn't do that back in 2004. I don't recall, but it was a lot harder to get information from some people because it was almost like I see it in the club sense because, in the club dance set, because DJs would cover their records, the record label, because people oftentimes you had the only copy. So you want to make sure that that's your signature. You got something that somebody else didn't have. Granted, I have a lot of songs nobody else had either, but that wasn't my way of going about it. So it was funny to me with these other guys that was like, dude, you're not reinventing the wheel. I'm like, just somebody's asking you because they're not necessarily a fan, but they're enthused. You made them feel a particular way. Tell them what song it is. It's fine. I'll talk music with anybody that walks up to me. It's, even when I'm DJing, I don't mind. It's, as long as they kind of realize, I might have to pick a song in a minute and recognize that I might have to avert my attention for a hot second. Also, they might not necessarily know which song they're trying to ask me about. So I have to go back in my head, since I don't write this stuff down, to figure out which song did they mean. So do you remember was it a male singer? Was it a female singer? Was it a group? Was it more guitar? Was it more horn? What was it? Well, I'm not very sure. Oh boy. Okay. Was it three songs back? Let me figure it out. Hang on. There's a lot that goes into it if you really think about it. But the arrogance, in a sense, that some of those other folks had, I wasn't standing for it. And if you look, it's a little petty, but it was kind of fun. If I couldn't wait to DJ with some of these people, because in my mind, I often would be thinking, in a few minutes, you will be one of those folks running over to your laptop to go change your pre-made set, because this is another evening right now. And this, you're not going to phone it in, or go ahead, phone it in, but you won't be happy about it.
I also really like the idea of, hey, treating music as proprietary versus not, right? You want to make sure that you understand your DJ style and your choices as a DJ are separate from like the actual songs. You could give somebody the exact same songs that you just played and they will not create the same set or the same feel. Because a lot of people think, oh, it's just good music. And as long as I have the music, I will be a successful DJ. But
yeah, it's not.
It is not that way. And so I am always very happy to share music with other DJs. Because I know they're not going to play it like me. Go ahead.
No, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. And here's a funny thing. Early on, I don't get to ask this question anymore, but early on, somebody asked me about being in a DJ battle. And I don't do that. Main reason I don't do that is because, first of all, it's not about me. It's not really about you either. So let's get over ourselves. It's about the dance floor. I'll DJ with someone. Can't wait to do that. We can trade songs. Let's do that. And then let's have some fun then, because then we're still working with the dance floor. Now, DJ battle, my idea of a real DJ battle is, I think, not what someone else wants. Some, DJ battle, DJ battle. And I was like, okay, this is a real DJ battle. Let's all line up laptops or, your laptops and my CDs, whatever. We're all sitting here. Everybody take a step to the right. Now play their music your way. What does that mean now? You need to know your own music, of course, but now you have to look at somebody else's list, somebody else's library, and find what you know. Talk about an oh shit moment.
Yes. And that's where when a DJ that has been DJing for a long time offers to open up their library to you, you know, it's both humbling and overwhelming, because how much more music do they have in terms of their years of experience in curating their library to the things they love, and how well they know that music is a testament to the love of the art form, to be able to walk over one laptop or one collection, right? And be able to work with it.
Well, this is the funny aspect about that. I remember going over a friend's house in New York, and we were hanging out, and they were talking and dancing and so on about what they were both organizers, you know, and I was not. So I'm just there. And I remember asking him, hey, while you guys are doing your thing, do you mind? I'm in your living room. I'm like, do you mind if I just play some of your music? Because, you know, it's here, and that I won't be, you know, I won't feel like a third wheel or anything, you know? Oh yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. I'm playing his, you know, picking songs off of his shelves. You know, I'm not kidding. This was really funny. It's happened a couple of times, but the first time was the funniest. He kept coming to me from what they were doing, and like, wow, that's really good. What is this? And I'd tell him, dude, what is this? And I'd tell him, what is this? And finally, I was like, dude, this is your music. This is your house. I'm like, why don't you listen to this? You got some really good stuff here. But you know what? I know what you did. I know exactly what you did. And it's part and parcel to what you said earlier about listening to the beginnings and the ends. It's you bought all these CDs or what have you, but you bought them for one song or two songs and you never listened to the rest of them. It's like, this is all your stuff. You've got a whole new set of things here. You should just have some fun. You should listen to your own things. I said, or you need to invite me over all the time. I guess maybe that's what's going to have to happen for you to hear your new music. But you're welcome. I'm glad to help you branch out with your own library, which I just thought was hilarious.
That is fantastic. When we're looking at our own libraries, how many CDs have we bought because we knew the one song on it?
One song.
And the opportunity we're missing out on to not sit and listen to that album from track one to track 12 or however many songs are on that CD, because there will be hidden gems in there that are never going to hit the radio. And if you are a DJ, those are the exact things you're looking for. You're spending a lot of time delving through old records, old CDs, things that aren't just on the top 40 to introduce to dancers, introduce to yourself. Yeah. There's a love affair with that. I feel it's very intimate to know an artist's work so completely that you can pull the deepest cuts from all of their work and feel like you know it.
Right on. It's really funny about that. I would go shopping when I was living in California. I mean, in New York, you'd go to, you know, at the time I'd go to Tower Records because it was, you know, that was there. And in California, it's Amoeba. Oh my God, Amoeba Records. To me, it was like Home Depot. It was like the space at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark for music. The funny thing about that is I'd go shopping and looking for different songs. I'm looking for different albums, looking for things that I don't know so I can listen to them. Some things I'd come home with a lot of CDs at once, but the thing I would notice that I can't do, it's like I'm stuck. It's almost too much. If I bought a box set and it's four, so I could do three, but something about that fourth disc, I'd get to the fourth disc and I can't take it all in. It just doesn't matter. I have a tremendous Wynonie Harris box set. Can't get through it. I can't. It won't hold. I've got a fantastic Sidney Bechet. It all won't stay there. It's just, okay. Now, if it had been three, maybe I got it. But that fourth disc, it's like, nope, Stephen, you're not going to make it. It's just keep listening. Keep listening. Joe Turner. Oh, I got to get this. Nope, not going to happen. I don't know why.
There are limits sometimes. And yet I do remember having a new, really great respect for your DJing when we were at Blues Quake in Oakland. And
oh my God.
So B.B. King had just died. B.B. King had just died. And I remember being so sad and thinking like, I wish a wider variety of his music were played at dances because we get the same three or four songs in rotation. And I feel like people are missing out on a lot of these deeper cuts. And you played a whole set in honor of B.B. King at Blues Quake in the evening and how powerful that was. And it reminded me, hey, there are people out there who will listen to an entire collection of somebody's work and find that. So I really did appreciate that about your DJing.
Wow. That I'd forgotten about that, but I just hadn't thought about it. I'm amazed that, thank you. Let me say that too, that A, for bringing back the memory and for letting me know that that's what I did. I remember that vividly. And if I recall correctly, what I did was I started that set by the use of silence, which was everybody stop because you're expecting me to play a song and I didn't. And I just kind of waited until everybody was kind of looking at me. And then I think I said something to the effect of, and even this was in the moment, I kind of knew what I was going to say to start where I was going. I had no idea what I was going to say fully, but I wanted to talk. I remember talking about who he was and what his legacy kind of is, you know, without diving into, you know, but so much history, but I wanted to wrap it into kind of a mystery of sorts in case people didn't know. And then for those that did, to bring it back without using his name until I was halfway through. We just lost a giant. I remember saying that sentence. And we went into about B.B. King. And then I asked for permission for the dance floor. It's like, do you mind if I play a bit of B.B. King? And that's kind of where we're going to stay for a little bit. And if you remember that set, there is a 9-minute medley.
Yes, there is that actually.
That was in that set. That's one of my favorites. That is one of my favorites. God, I love that. One of the problems that I had with a computer, with a laptop, was I had not figured out fully how to seamlessly run that. And I would do so with CDs, obviously, because I could control it better. I was not that well-versed, especially at that time, playing one, because it is one song, but it's actually three. So there's a break with the file on your laptop. So I was like, oh my God, am I going to have to mix it fully? And I was like, you know, I'm just going to play my CDs. I can't be bothered with all that. But I like to do that. I'm so glad you brought that up. I like to do that with the artist that I see that has given us so much. And we're able to hear this music and enjoy it. And even if you don't know it, I want us to recognize it, you know, in one way, shape, or form. Even if it's four songs, it's not going to kill us. It's, you know what, this is music that we're enjoying, that I love. And I'm hoping that you guys too. Why not recognize? And then hopefully that recognition will help us and me and other people delve in to like, God, who were these guys? I want to know more. So that way I don't miss the next one. I don't miss the next one. I want to see the next one before you lose them. Because so many of these people passed before we got a chance to see them or hear them.
It's very true. And as a blues scholar, I am always thinking, oh, I wish that I had found blues or taken blues seriously earlier, years earlier, because then maybe I'd have met this artist or I've seen them live. I'd have got to interview them, know them, right? There's always that sense. And so being able to go to blues festivals and to find the new music and the new musicians so that I can get to know their music at the very least and who they are, their journey as an artist. Yeah. There's a lot of power in that, not just as a scholar, even though that's my personal interest.
Sure.
It is as a dancer and as a community that consumes Black music, that consumes mm-hmm. these art forms that are the base of so much innovation and are still innovating. It's not history, it's current.
This country didn't really embrace it. You know, they did, and then it stopped, you know, because rock and roll got big. Rock and roll, rock and roll. It was rock and roll. Okay, so these artists don't have anything to do. And so it seemed. And overseas, oh, wait, they love it. So they would go and travel there and they'd play there. And the weird thing about this is, I'm trying to think where I saw this quote and it said, not only would the British invasion do what it did for us, you know, musically, for the music industry here in America, what it also did was they took America's blues music and sold it back to us. And I remember reading, I either read it or heard someone say it. I can't think who it was, but I remember that stuck out to me. I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what happened. That's the nerve. It's like it was already here. And it's like you weren't paying attention. And it's like someone bought your house up under you. And then, oh man, that sucks. Well, I have a house to sell you. You just happen to be sitting in it. You know, it's like, well, all right then. You don't have a whole lot of choice there. It's so, it's so mean in a way. I mean, but it's kind of funny. You can't help it. Which reminds me of something. I just got to throw this in here. One afternoon, I was DJing in St. Louis. I actually got lost. I said to one of my other blues homes, right? I got lost on the way to the venue, which was outdoors. God, this is so much fun. And I think Jerry was DJing. So I remember calling. I was like, I think I'm almost in Illinois, or maybe I was. I took a wrong turn. Can you keep going? But I'm coming. So Jerry was having a great set, having a really good time, got the dance floor steaming. I get there, finally, get set up. And this turned into, the reason I'm saying this, you'll see exactly why. God, I cherish this. I'm playing music. I'm like, okay, I'm here. Let's go. And dance floor's working it about, because it was outdoors and it was a public space. In fact, people are walking by and so on and see all of us dancing and hear me playing the music and whatnot. And about 6-7 older Black folks walked by and they stopped, came back. And one of the gentlemen walked up to me, and he was quite a bit older than me, actually. He might have been in, at that time, I think I was 43, I think, something like that. So he was clearly in his 60s, if I recall correctly, or maybe almost 70. And he walked up and he said, he was crying, tears in this man's eyes. And his first thing he said was, where are these white folks going to dance like this? The first thing he said to me. And I was like, there's a lot going on here. I said, you know, this is pretty good. I said, a lot of this going on around the country. And I said, I'm really glad because, you know, they're playing this music. And he said, yeah. He goes, about the music. He said, I have not heard this. I was playing an Elmore James song. He said, I've not heard this in years. He goes, my father used to play this music for me. And it's like, and he's crying. It's like, you don't hear this. And I was like, well, if you're around us, you're going to hear this a lot. So, you know, I'm like, this is, especially around me, I'm playing this. This is one of my favorites. Okay, when my father taught me too about this, and I'm playing another song, and he's standing there. I look up, and everybody, I couldn't have been more proud of this moment. Everyone that he was with was dancing with our group, and it was just like seamless the rest of my set. And I was like, okay, I know it hadn't happened. Yeah, right. I was like, I hadn't thought it in the moment, but right now I am. If I had thought it, then I would have said it. I'd be like, I'm king of the world. I was like, oh my God, to be able to do that. I just felt so much love and pride in that moment, because it's like I said earlier, I'm introducing my father, all this music my father taught me and didn't know that he taught me. You know, he used, when I was little and even into my teens, I'm into my own music now. And my father would come in my room and he'd go, hey, you know what? That's what you're playing right there. That's really good. You know, whether it's Earth, Wind, and Fire, or whether it was Funkadelic, or, you know, whoever the artist was. My father goes, would leave for a second and come right back with a record or two. And he goes, the folks that are on that used to play here. Listen to this. And he did this for years. And he would always do this to me. Years later, in 2003, near the end of 2003, I'm sitting here where I am now in North Carolina, in what was my parents' house. And my father is dying of cancer. And he's sitting in the chair I'm sitting in. I was across the room. And my father's talking to me about blues music. Oh, man, you got to hear this. And it was one of his favorites, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. And you got to hear, play this and so on. And I'd go, you know, I really like that. I was like, I love this one. And then I played something else that I had, and he had a very funny look on his face, but this kept going. This must have happened, like, he goes, oh, and it was almost like, can you top this? He was like, okay, well, how about this one? And another artist, and so on. I go, God, yeah, oh, that is fantastic. You know what I really like also is this. And then I'd play something else, and or I'd mention something else. We must have gone through a bunch of different artists, and all of a sudden my father looks at me like he hadn't seen me before. And he said, how do you know so much about this music like this? And I said, from you. And he looked at me and I said, oh, I said, all those years you were coming to me all those times you were coming to me and showing me the album and telling me who was on this that was now playing on that and where they came from. I said, the thing you didn't know was that I was really listening. And my father was shocked. And he actually died a month later. And this is the first time I've ever gotten through this story without crying.
Very powerful story.
Yeah, I'll say. Yeah, but that's totally where it is. That's totally where it is. That's where I come from with this. It's all about the music. It's all about that energy. It's hard to put into words. If somebody asks you about one of the other mistakes, which is what I tend to say, and I'm not sure if I think Dave Madison might have said this to me, and I kind of picked up on it. It's like clever DJ syndrome. What's clever DJ? And I would say, don't be a clever DJ. Clever DJ is you've got this one song. Oh my God, this is going to be so great. It's so good. It's so good. It's so good. And it might be, but you know what? You're never going to put that song in the spot where you need it. It's never going to work. You're going to drop that song in the middle of something, and it is going to change the flow of exactly what you've been doing for the past 45 minutes. It all of a sudden, everybody's like, and it's not as good of a song anymore. All of a sudden, you're like, oh, now it sounds a little different to you. I don't know why. Just can't necessarily be that clever. It's just like, okay. It's best not to do that. Let's not be the clever DJ. Keep your own set, your own flow, not to just drive a wedge through everybody because you've got a bright idea. Like sometimes it's better to just keep going with your own inspiration, not with your prior, which is part of the set list idea that, you know, that we were talking about earlier as well.
Yes, it's not making it harder than it is.
Like I said, this to me, and I have to thank you, Chelsea, because this, and I thank Tom because Tom mentioned this to me. My father, again, brought me up listening to old radio recordings, you know, of dramatic shows, horror, suspense, and so on. I have the records now still. I don't even have a turntable, and I need to get one. But I have all those old records that he had and that he gave me. And that's what instilled my love for radio. I would rather listen to a good broadcaster give me the baseball game it's or the basketball game. So you paint the mental picture. It's riveting. I mean, I love it. I love television. I work in television. I love film. I work in film. But radio, that the mind's eye is something you can't duplicate. It's something else entirely. And when someone does it right, there you are. You're on the edge of your seat.
I hope that this podcast has kept you on the edge of your seat and that you've enjoyed it. And I hope you'll join us next month for another episode of the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider hitting the subscribe button so that you always catch the latest episodes. 12 Bar Talk is hosted, recorded, and produced by me, Dr. Chelsea Adams, and supported by Salt City Blues, LLC, a blues dance event company located in Salt Lake City, Utah.